Hi, this is Ezra. You're listening to Two Queers, Five Books, an outgrowth of another podcast called Two Queers, Four Questions. In this one, Agnes and I are learning the weekly Torah portion and finding out what there is to say about it, uncovering its queer side. I wanted to mention, which I haven't before, that the text of these episodes can be found at tumblr.com/2q5b. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for learning with us. Hope you enjoy.
Ki Tisa. There's often a moment before a collapse that the collapse really begins. I've had relationships where there's a thought, something like, oh, I think this might be over, that appears in the mind, and I might persuade myself that I can make things work, and not yet, and I don't really want it to end, and relationships take work, etc., etc., but some part of me knows that it's already over. The thought has been had. The threshold has been crossed. It's just a matter of time. I have it with migraines, too. Oh, I'm going to have a migraine in a few minutes, I find myself thinking, and sure enough, in a few minutes, the familiar symptoms, the sensitivity on the skin, the fleck of blur at the edges of my vision. I'm nervous to say this now, honestly worried that the thinking will bring one on. There are beginnings, and then there are the beginnings before the beginnings. This week, we read about one of the biggest collapses in the history of our people, a mess for which we bear sole responsibility. God brought us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm. God brought us through the desert to the foot of Mount Sinai, where we heard God's voice, saw the sounds. The mountain was consumed in fire and smoke. And the first thing we heard, the most important really, was, I am your God. You shall have no other gods before me. This is too terrible, we said, too overwhelming. We get it, we get it. Please, Moses, go up and get the rest of the message for us. And he does, and we wait at the bottom of the mountain, slowly recovering and beginning to make sense of where we've been, what has been done to us and for us. A week goes by, 2 weeks, three, five, six. 6 weeks. 6 weeks is time, but not that much time. If we had applied for an artist's residency, say, we'd never expect to hear back in 6 weeks. We'd give it, what, 3 months? Four at best. 6 weeks is enough time to worry, but you'd think not so long that we'd forget the feeling of the voice, the rumbling of the mountain. And yet we seem to lose our cool, and we come to Aaron, panicky, sweating, fidgeting, unable to make eye contact, and we insist that we need a new God, one we can see and touch, one who can lead us through the desert. Aaron spooks, it's something in our eye, it's a little scary, and he goes along with it. I have this theory that the seed of this great betrayal, this moment of idolatry, the moment before the collapse, when the collapse really begins, is in a single word, yada, no. Come, make us a God who shall go before us, for that fellow Moses, the man who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has happened to him. Lo yadanu mahayalo. What kind of statement is that? We do not know what has happened to him. They're talking about knowledge, but really they're avoiding talking about all the things they're feeling. They might have said, Aaron, we're terrified. We need guidance. We are panicking. The future seems unfathomable. The journey ahead overwhelming. What kind of God, what kind of leader leaves us alone in this state? Help us. They might have said, Aaron, we're angry. We feel betrayed by this silence, by all the destruction wreaked on the place where we were born, by the suffering of the people we knew back in Egypt. What kind of God, what kind of leader would want to cause that kind of misery even in the name of our freedom? Help us. But no. They take all their fear and anger and trauma and they try to contain it, to clean the edges off of it, to wrap it neatly in this neat little word, no, we do not know. And they throw it petulantly in Aaron's face, asking him to take responsibility, as if knowing Moses' whereabouts would ease the terror of freedom, resolve the catastrophe of unequally distributed suffering, as if what they're facing is a failure of knowledge and not a crisis of being. The parsha begins with the census, an attempt to figure out how many people are in the camp. You take a census when you want to know who exactly you are. But we are told in a roundabout way that we have to be careful when we take a census. It can be dangerous to count the people. When you take a census of the Israelite men, according to the army enrollment, each shall pay God a ransom for himself on being enrolled. that no plague may come upon them through their being enrolled. It is as if being counted makes us vulnerable. Knowledge does not offer security here. It opens us up to danger. On a certain level, it's superstition. You get counted and you make yourself vulnerable to the evil eye. Isn't there a rule where it's bad luck to point at someone? It's like that. 16th century Italian commentator Sforno has a beautiful read on this, actually. Why is it that we need to count? He asks. We need to count because the number of us is always changing. And why is the number always changing? Because we're mortal. And why are we mortal? Because back in Eden we sinned. Every census, he says, is a reminder of sin. God has reason to punish sinners. So a census may be a practical necessity, Sforno tells us, but every time we undertake it, we are putting ourselves in grave danger. I love this reading. I'm not sure I agree that sin is the right framework to describe what happens in Eden, but I am very moved by the idea that knowledge is somehow deeply entangled with a sense of our own vulnerability, our history of violence, our inheritance of fear. The parts of us that want to know are the mortal parts of us. They are small, tender, exposed, and we deny that connection at our own peril. We live in a world where knowledge is a source of power, control. It is our knowledge, we think, that keeps us safe. Science will save us from climate change. The experts know best how to solve this or that global crisis. If I can analyze my emotions and how they arise from particular patterns in my family, they will not overtake me so totally. I will not have to feel them. I do believe in scholarship. I believe in reflection and research and learning and therapy. But I also know that when knowledge becomes a shield that we think can protect us from fear and uncertainty and the precariousness that is a part of being human, then it quickly becomes a kind of false god. Later, in 2 Samuel, God will get angry at the people and incite King David against them. And what does David do when he gets worked up? He calls for a census. His advisor seems to know what is going on. He says, "Are you sure?" And David says, "Yes, definitely, do it." So they do the census. And when David has cooled down a little bit, he feels bad. Afterward, David reproached himself for having numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, "I have sinned grievously in what I have done. Please, O Lord, remit the guilt of your servant, for I have acted foolishly." Suffice to say, things don't go well after that. This week's Parsha ends in a plague. So does 2 Samuel. Neither plague follows directly from the census. Other things happen in between. The connection is not direct. But when you zoom out, it's hard not to feel the inevitability of the link between this act of counting ourselves, which Sforno tells us is a kind of shameful reminder of our own mortality, and this spectacular moment of mass death. The narrative ducks and weaves. It's like we're not allowed to draw a straight line. That would be too easy, too rational. The story won't let itself be known that way, parsed that cleanly. The actual unfolding is wayward, startling, scary, violent, unpredictable. At the same time, seeking knowledge is a part of what we do. It's not if you take a census, it's when you take a census. We need our scientists, we need our historians, our statisticians, our doctors, our brilliant weirdos with deep wells of learning and experience, but we need to pair that urge towards understanding with a necessary humility. When we take up knowledge, we must also remind ourselves of our fragile mortality. We must pay a ransom, each of us, a provisional prayer that we might be spared. The angel of death came through Egypt and slew all the firstborns. The angel of death didn't know Egyptian from Israelite. The angel of death just knew to skip the houses with the blood on the doorpost. The Egyptians are the ones who lost their children that night, but the Israelites left knowing that for their freedom they owed a life too. They were not exempt. They were just spared. And so they pay a ransom. There's literally a ceremony for this, Pidyon HaBen, in which parents pay a certain amount of money to a Kohen to redeem the life of their firstborn child. The implication of the census in this week's Parsha is that we all need to be so redeemed. I read this Parsha and I am reminded of something my rabbi said recently. "Do not entrench," she said, meaning don't dig yourself into a certain position and refuse to be moved. I read this Parsha and I am reminded that my anguish, my grief, my rage have something to teach, that I cannot avoid them by either deflecting engagement onto something else, or onto someone else with more experience, Do not treat knowledge like a god. Do not entrench. Do not treat knowledge like a shield. Do not deflect. Let us remember what it is we are here for. We are here to take care of ourselves and each other, to walk with mystery, to honor the divinity that surrounds us, to work steadily and unrelentingly for a more whole and just world. We are here, in the words of my prayer book, to praise, to labor, and to love. What false idols are we worshiping? Is our desire to serve God and God's vision of justice, or is our desire to be right? We are limited. We are vulnerable. Let us seek knowledge, but let us do it in a way that acknowledges our fear, our anger, our hope, our desire, and our mortality. Just before David orders a census taken of the people, we are told that the anger of the Lord again flared up against Israel. Rashi offers a comment on this verse. It is unclear from the text what the Israelites did that provoked God this time. And what is it that Rashi says? I do not know what it was they did. I simply do not know.